This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Right now, across the world, 110 million people that have fled their homes because of conflict, persecution, discrimination, violence, often mixed with other factors like the impact of climate change. These people leave behind everything and they're forced to endure unbelievable hardships and discrimination and no fault of their own.
That was James Belgrave, spokesperson for the World Food Programme, WFP, on his thoughts today. World Refugee Day. Details coming up. Also, fears of renewed fighting increase as Sudan's three-day ceasefire draws to an end. And vote counting continues in Mali's constitutional referendum. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. More than 110 million people around the world have faced threats so dire, war, disaster, climate change, disease, hunger, that they had no choice but to flee their countries with their families, in some cases with nothing more than the clothes on their backs. Millions more are displaced in their home countries, unable to return to their communities. Maybe they will be lucky and someday return home or find a new home to rebuild their lives. But others risk death or exploitation, trekking across deserts or across the sea in overcrowded, leaky boats. Still others live for years, even decades, in a crowded refugee camp in a foreign country, a nomad, dependent on aid agencies for food, water, shelter, and clothes, with limited medical care and education. Today is World Refugee Day. In our program today, we join the world in celebrating the courage of people who have made the gut-wrenching decision to flee. We talk with refugees and aid agencies to bring their stories to the world. James Belgrave is spokesperson for the World Food Programme, WFP. He starts out by talking to me about the significance of the day and points out that refugees are forced to endure unbelievable hardship and discrimination.
World Refugee Day, to me and certainly to the World Food Programme, is a moment to reflect on one of the world's most vulnerable and forgotten groups of people. Right now, across the world, 110 million people that have fled their homes because of conflict, persecution, discrimination, violence, often mixed with other factors like the impact of climate change. These people leave behind everything and they're forced to endure unbelievable hardships and discrimination and no fault of their own.
And James, I just found out that the World Food Programme, WFP, works very closely with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, during emergencies and long-term crisis to provide food to uprooted people around the world, especially women and children. Could you talk to us about that collaboration?
Yeah. So, I mean, we work very closely with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. Obviously, you know, as the most vulnerable people, some of the most vulnerable groups, refugees are a big priority for us. And, I mean, just last year in 2022, we provided food assistance to between 9 to 10 million refugees in countries all across the world. But I mean, if I could focus in on one situation which is really worrying for us, I think, and it really highlights the issues that we at the World Food Programme are facing in 2023, is Chad. So Chad in West Africa hosts one of the largest refugee populations in the Western Central Africa region, with over 700,000 refugees. Since clashes broke out in Sudan in April, we've seen more than 150,000 new refugees crossing into the country. Chad is a situation as a country where WFP is facing massive funding shortfalls, which mean that despite the massive need, we are unable to provide adequate assistance to refugees. But this year, as we see donor funding drying up, we've been forced to gradually provide less and less food, and tragically to less and less people. We've got a similar situation in Tanzania, in Burundi, Uganda, and the list goes on and on.
And James, you mentioned Chad, and Chad is very close to Sudan, and Sudan has been thrown into a turmoil by the civil war. The situation in Sudan also needs to be addressed, and it exacerbates the whole situation with Chad.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Sudan is a very clear example of the origin of a lot of refugees. You know, where you have conflict, where you have fighting, where you have violence, people flee their homes. And Sudan is a clear example of this situation. You know, there's been fighting inside the country, a lot of clashes. Millions of people have been forced to flee their homes. We've seen, you know, 1.6 million people who've already been displaced by the conflict, both inside Sudan and into Ethiopia, Egypt, South Sudan, Chad, and the Central African Republic. Now, we as the World Food Programme, we work closely with local partners and host governments to ensure that these people are fed. But so long as there's fighting, it's very difficult for us to do our jobs. You know, there's insecurity, access is an issue. We can't access the people that have been uprooted from their homes. And it's a really difficult, difficult situation.
Are there any hot spots around Africa besides Chad and Sudan that we need to worry about?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point, actually, that, you know, despite the massive number of refugees that we do have in Africa, so, you know, you can look at the situation in South Sudan with all the millions of people that have fled there, Sudan, as I just mentioned, you've got West Africa and the Sahel, the Democratic Republic of Congo is ongoing fighting, Burundi, Somalia, you know, the list goes on and on.
That was James Belgrave, spokesperson for the World Food Programme, speaking with me from Harare, Zimbabwe. The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Society says the first quarter of 2023 has been the deadliest on record for refugees. The UN Refugee Agency says last year wasn't any better. The number of people who were forcibly displaced by war, persecution, human rights abuses, and climate change reached an all-time high of 110 million. VOA's Carol Van Dam takes a look at what's behind these statistics.
Each year, thousands of refugees risk everything by leaving their homes, but many never reach their destination. Last Wednesday's sinking of a packed migrant boat off the coast of Greece is being described by EU officials as possibly the worst tragedy ever in the Mediterranean Sea. Dozens of people died and hundreds more are missing when the boat capsized and sank. Georgios Vassilagos from Patras, Greece, is a physician with the Hellenic Red Cross who helped treat survivors at Kalamata Port. He told me last week most of the migrants were suffering from hypothermia, but they were more worried about what's to come next.
We focused mainly on the medical operations. However, we could see on their faces that they are struggling for survival. They don't know what comes tomorrow.
The UN Refugee Agency reported last week that the war in Ukraine, revised estimates for Afghan refugees, and the outbreak of new conflicts, especially in Sudan, drove the sharp rise in the number of people forced to flee their homes. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi says the growing number of forcibly displaced is being met with stronger hostility toward refugees worldwide.
We see pushbacks, we see tougher and tougher immigration or refugee admission rules. We see in many countries a criminalization of immigrants and refugees, blaming them for everything that has happened and so forth.
International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society spokesperson Tommaso Della Longa says fighting in one country often affects several countries. Hundreds of thousands of Sudanese have fled into neighboring Chad, Ethiopia, Egypt, and South Sudan, he says. Della Longa says no matter where refugees come from or why they are fleeing, they all deserve to be treated with respect.
As a humanitarian, I'm not even interested in why a person decide to migrate. My point is that the person who decide to migrate needs to access to services regardless of his or her own status and needs to be treated in a human way and needs to be protected.
Ding Magad is a South Sudanese journalist who formerly reported for VOA. She came to the United States last year to attend a conference. Weeks before then, security officers arrested her in Juba, where she was covering a protest. She was detained for more than a week. When she was freed, she left to attend the conference and never went back for fear of reprisals. She tells me not everyone is friendly here in Washington.
Sometimes not everyone will be friendly towards you. People have their perceptions about immigrants and refugees, and those are some of the challenges that I have faced while seeking asylum.
Have they been out and out mean, or have they said anything to you, or acted in a certain way? Like, can you give me an example?
No, I can just feel like, you know, sometimes, like, when you watch the news, or even just when you talk to someone, and the first thing people will ask you, like, why are you here? Why did you leave your country? then, you know, sometimes it's like I feel like I have to defend myself.
Many refugees from Africa flee to a neighboring country. The UNHCR's Global Trends report says countries in sub-Saharan Africa host 1 in 5 of all refugees globally. The largest number, 4.7 million, are in East Africa, the Horn of Africa, and the Great Lakes region. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
VOA has heard from residents of the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, home to nearly 200,000 refugees from around the region. Monica Yuol was born in the camp in 1998 after her parents fled her from South Sudan. She grew up in the camp and went to school there. After a secondary school, she has started to train in media and hopes to use those skills to help others in the camp.
Currently, I'm working with IOM, RSC Africa Resettlement Support Center, as an interpreter. Yes, as interpreter, and it's something that I'm enjoying. I always love to support, and in any whatever way, if I'm giving back to the community, then it's something that I always love. And I started to come up with an initiative that is called Refugee Teens Talk. The initiative is educating teenage mothers and empowering them, as well as young girls. And
that was Monica Yuol, a resident of the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya. Thousands of Sudanese continue to flee the war in their country every day, with many making the long trek south to Kenya. While a fortunate few have friends willing to help them, most of the new refugees are forced to live at the Dadaab refugee complex. While the burden is heavy, some analysts say it is in Kenya's interest to help the new refugees, part of the flood of 500,000 people who have fled Sudan's conflict by the UN's count, and make an effort to end the war in the neighboring country. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Journalingo and Press. This is Shakur Nyaketo.
33-year-old Shakur Nyaketo found shelter in this apartment in Kenya's capital several weeks after he fled his home in Khartoum, Sudan.
One day ceasefire has been very...
Nyaketo, a teacher and journalist, says he took off with his 7 months pregnant wife after their home was attacked by the paramilitary rapid support forces. Nyaketo is out of work. He spends his time updating his followers on events in Sudan through podcasts. His once successful career in broadcasting and teaching, he says, is in limbo.
Actually, it makes me feel very hopeless. It makes me feel very bad and stranded. I don't really know what to do and where to go and how even to do it. And in my country, I was very well established. I was doing my work, my business.
Nyaketo is among the estimated 2 million civilians who have been displaced because of the armed conflict between rival factions of the military government of Sudan. Nyaketo says, all things considered, he and his wife are doing all right.
I'm in a safe place, and I can access anything. I can access internet. I can communicate. I can go to media houses. My wife can be able to go to the hospital and everything. We are expecting her to give birth in 2 or 3 weeks.
Nyaketo is the exception. Most Sudanese refugees in Kenya are living at the Dadaab refugee camps, which are already home to hundreds of thousands of refugees from Somalia and South Sudan. In a report this month, Doctors Without Borders say the camp is already overcrowded with new arrivals and resources there that were already limited and now overstretched. A number of efforts to stop the war in Sudan have failed, but analysts like Masharia Munene, an international relations professor at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, say Kenya has a special interest in ending the conflict because the number of refugees arriving on its territory is growing.
It's going to be a strain on the country. In fact, that's one of the main reasons why Kenya has to be involved in finding a solution there. So once they are stable, the people don't have to run away.
Many of the Sudanese refugees entering Kenya and other countries have no one to help them and are effectively abandoned, says Doctors Without Borders. Abdisalam Adan Mohammed runs a training center in Nairobi where refugees can learn a local language and other skills. He told VOA it's crucial for host countries to protect escaping Sudanese.
to make sure that people can pass peacefully, and then they create a safe houses for them in the border to help the people are running from the fighting. They are not traumatized and they have safety, and then give them counseling.
Kenya is host to more than 500,000 refugees, and their numbers are growing as conflicts in the region continue to rage. Exiled civilians like Shakur hope they can return to a peaceful country one day soon. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
From a distance, the abandoned three-room building looks well-built. However, one refugee says conditions inside the refugee center at a farm in Bronkhorstspruit, 50 kilometers east of Pretoria, are heartbreaking. Mothers, fathers, and children are crammed inside the three rooms. Their luggage is piled along the walls, with some around them to demarcate each family's living space. These are the spaces they use for bathing, dining, sleeping, and with zero privacy. About 100 refugees, many from the Democratic Republic of Congo, were taken to the farm in April after South African police evicted them from a camp in front of the UN Refugee Agency's offices in Pretoria. They had been demanding that UNHCR resettle them in other countries to escape xenophobic violence in South Africa. Refugee Rukombo Kiese told VOA they have been treated like animals at the farm.
The condition is so very, very, very bad because this is a bush. There's no one is living here. There's no water here. The toilet is not working. We're just making the toilet in the bush here, the way you see.
One student who did not want to be named told VOA that there is no school for them.
I feel like unsafe, traumatized, and I just feel so bad.
The area is about 15 kilometers from the nearest communities. Johnny Russo, who has three children at the camp, blames UNHCR for refusing to move them to another country. He is still traumatized by xenophobic violence he says he has experienced since 2019.
Those people, when they are coming, they're going to attack you. You can't even believe it. Some of them, they are not coming like to steal. No, to sabotage, to make sabotage. They burn my car. They're going to burn everything if they find. If you don't mistake, they're going to kill you.
Over the past several years, South Africa has seen waves of anti-foreigner protests and attacks driven in part by the country's weakening economy and unemployment rate, which tops 30%. When the refugee camp was broken up in April, Laura Pardon, UNHCR spokesperson, disputed allegations the agency wasn't helping the protesters.
We will be working with authorities closely and following up and carefully monitoring the situation to ensure that the refugees are given the proper advice, counselling and protection that they need.
The government has also aided the refugees to reintegrate into local communities, but the group insists on going to another country. Reporting for VOA News in Johannesburg, I am Tuso Kumalo.
As the world marks World Refugee Day, you just heard Tuso Kumalo reporting from Johannesburg. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Vote counting continues in Mali's constitutional referendum held Sunday. Mali's military junta organized the referendum as a step towards a return to constitutional rule and a new presidential election expected next year in the West African country. The draft constitution would strengthen the presidency, providing broad powers to determine policy and appoint the prime minister and ministers, and to terminate their functions. Reporter Elysia Volkman in Tunis spoke to Dr. Andrew Levovich, a research fellow with the Sahel program at the Klingendael Institute in the Netherlands, Institute of International Relations, for a look at the significance of the referendum.
The votes of Sunday's constitutional referendum held in Mali are still being counted. Earliest results are expected on Tuesday. So what is the significance of Colonel Assimi Goïta's military junta holding this referendum? Dr. Andrew Lebovich, a research fellow from the Sahel program at the Klingendael Institute, explains.
The importance of the constitutional referendum for the junta, for the transitional government, is to really create a more official status, not just for the government, but moving forward to guarantee amnesty for those who staged coups, but also potentially to clear the way, not just for planned elections and the movement out of a transitional government, but potentially, as some believe, to clear the way for junta members to stand for office and to stand even for the presidency. So it is quite important that for the government to at least show that they've held the referendum, regardless of any doubts that have been raised and will be raised almost certainly about the results.
What is at stake in the referendum? How likely are the junta's constitutional changes going to win the yes vote?
It's highly unlikely, as things are tallied, that there will be any significant no vote. And we've already seen from some areas overwhelming yes votes in favor of the constitution, despite accusations of voter fraud in some cases or stuffing ballots, and despite the insecurity. So for the government, a yes is a rubber stamp, as it were, and something they can take forward and say that they have the approval of the Malian citizenry for their, not just for their own reforms, but for the transitional government itself.
There are reports of problems with voting in many areas and even violence. How much confidence can anyone place in the final results?
I don't think many outside observers place much confidence in the results, though even without voter fraud, it wasn't really likely for various reasons that the Constitution would be voted down. So on the one hand, there isn't much confidence, I think, in the final results. But for the transitional government, I don't think it matters very much, as long as they can still move forward with their agenda.
Colonel Assimi Goïta says he plans to return Mali to civilian rule in 2024. But if voting was so problematic this time around, after Goïta having mounted not one but two military coups in 2021, how likely is a return to civilian rule and democracy?
We've certainly seen ongoing delays and delays in different parts of the transitional plan to move toward a civilian government. I do think eventually we'll likely see some sort of a civilian government and return to a semblance of democratic rule. Whether that's really representative will be a different question. And also with a return to civilian rule, of course, one of the big questions is going to be whether or not Assimi Goïta or another member of the military junta will end up running for president or someone very close to them. So I do think that eventually we will see return to a semblance of civilian rule, but the members of the transitional government, the military junta, will likely remain very powerful and very predominant regardless.
For Voice of America Africa, I'm Alicia Faulkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
That was Dr. Andrew Lebovich, a research fellow with the Sahel program at the Klingendael Institute. He was speaking with reporter Eliza Volkman by phone. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokibilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station,